Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and I've been the host over the 12 Days of Doctrine. Today, on the 12th day of Doctrine, Special Doctrine Division is giving to you, our listeners, a serving of tea. We began the 12 Days of Doctrine with Brigadier General Babich, looking at the evolution of doctrine in the 70s and 80s, and truly how iterative the transformation was at that time. Through the conversations over the last 11 days, we've seen a need for integration and innovation, just as General Babich shared from General Starry's writings in the 70s and 80s. Today is another reflection from two soon-to-be-retired doctrine leaders, Mr. Jim Benn, Deputy Director at CAD, and Mr. Chuck Schrenkel, Chief of the Command and Control Division. These two gentlemen have served in the doctrine community over the past 20-plus years. So before they leave us, we wanted to hear how they have seen doctrine change over time. Maybe they'll give us a glimpse of how they see doctrine changing in the future, or maybe it won't change. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
Mr. Benn, could you start us off?
Sure.
As you reflect on your career, so both in uniform and as an Army civilian professional at CAD, how have you seen doctrine evolve over the years?
Well, the first observation I would make is not strictly about doctrine, but what has been required for leaders and soldiers to be true professionals. The knowledge that they had to have and the discussions that they would have as they talked about their jobs, and what I've seen over the past almost 50 years is how the discussions used to be very almost simplistic about just the tactical task, the performance of tactical tasks. And in many ways now, when you hear Captain's Career Course and ILE students having discussions, they're really higher order discussions about the conduct of operations and the implications of applying military capabilities, you know, to solve problems. And that's kind of a very complicated and convoluted lead-in to kind of pick up on what General Babich was saying about the 70s and 80s. And so my takeaway from those very early days of my military life, I saw two things take root in the 70s and 80s. I heard, and I think I was listening to senior leaders in the 70s talk about the levels of war and operational art for the first time in the late 70s, but it was really the 1980s when the ideas and the implications of understanding the levels of war and a real appreciation for the operational art really, you know, caught fire in the 1980s. And so those changes, those kinds of discussions and understanding had huge implications for doctrine. I sometimes give a presentation about the evolution, again, of being an Army professional. It's been every 10 years, there was a different theme for being an Army professional. You know, in the 1970s, your senior mentors would talk to you about being a master of your branch. You had to understand your branch and everything in it, all the systems, all the capabilities, but mastering your branch marked you as a true professional. By the time Grenada happened and we got Goldwater Nichols, the mark of the 80s was jointness. That was through some hard lessons learned, but that was the theme and the characteristic of the discussions we had, and obviously the requirements that put on doctrine. And so the 90s, we learned, first time we had done a large scale multinational operation in a while. But by the mid 90s, we were talking about war and operations other than war. And so these were the changes in my early life, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, that had huge implications for doctrine. And by the 90s, that was the first time that I saw on a large scale, we were asking people to do things that they hadn't done before. In the 70s and until the 1986 version of FM 100-5, until airland battle was starting to be understood, for it was my experience that we were doing largely what our peers and our immediate mentors were coaching us to do. By the time we got to trying to operationalize airland battle, that's when I saw the Army really take a serious look at reading doctrine. And so, Chuck, I don't know if you...
Yeah, no, I agree with you on the, you know, being tactically focused versus kind of operational work focused. Just a couple observations. First, you mentioned in your intro, Lisa, that General Babbage talked about kind of some of the changes that were going on and how doctrine is having to adjust. And now we're doing transformation and contact, and it's a big deal. But like the fact of the matter is doctrine has transformed continuously ever since I've been doing this, right? So if you go back and look at airland battle, was a response to the Soviet Union, and we dragged some lessons learned out of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War into that. 1993, the big idea was, the wall was down, the Soviet Union was disbanded, and kind of the big ideas back then was Mutwa and Utwa, operations other than war and military operations other than war. And the Army really disliked that book. And then, 2001, full spectrum operations rolls around, and that's kind of us trying to take into account the stability idea that the 93 version tried to account for. And then that was around for a couple of years, and now we have multi-domain operations to address the current threat. And we don't have all the equipment yet to do that stuff, but we didn't have all the equipment to do airline battle either when it first came out. So we'll get there. But that's the first big point is that doctrine has, I think, stayed up with the times. And in fact, I think we can change faster than force can actually accommodate changes mentally. You know, there's only so much capacity for change out there before people get overwhelmed. I think you saw some of that at one point in time. But there has been a huge change. If you go back and look at our earlier operations manuals, and you got about 10 years on me, but it was very much tactically focused, right? And it was all about absolutes. You know, as an artilleryman, like the CFL belongs to the division commander, the FSCL belongs to the corps commander, and you just took that on faith because you were a company grade officer and you were getting indoctrinated into the Army. And it wasn't until later that you learned, like, well, there's no real black and white answer on a lot of things. And you see in our operations doctrine, we go from being a very tactically focused Army, almost every version of 100-5 up until 2008 had like chapters on offense and defense. And it talked about like how you conduct an offense and a defense, which is really, really important. But we kind of have a tactics manual to tell you how to do that. By 2008, when we published FM 3.0, it was almost entirely an operational art book. You know, there was nothing in there on offense and defense. It was just kind of very, high level kind of book that's out there. Now, I think we probably went too far, in that version, because when General Lundy had us redo it, he tried to focus back on the basics again, on the tactics piece of it. We put big chapters on offense and defense in that book. And so I think that like we're always struggling for this balance of higher order thinking and wanting our folks to be good thinkers versus, hey, at a certain point in your career, you got to know the basic blocking and tackling really, really well, okay? Like squad, platoon, company level really need to know what they're doing. They need to be deep experts at that level, because if you can't do that, all the higher level thinking in the world isn't gonna save your butt, in my opinion.
I absolutely agree. If you think about what it took, again, to operationalize their airland battle, we had the big five systems, the Apache, the Black Hawk, the Bradley, the Abrams, and the MLRS. So we had the big five systems, but we knew that we wanted to do deep operations, but we hadn't mastered the art of it. So I remember I was assigned to, I went to Germany in 1988, and I was in an Apache brigade. We kept rehearsing and trying to figure out how would we integrate JSTARS to help us with its moving target indicator capabilities. We were trying to figure out how we were going to, we had the fundamentals. If doctrine consists one of the components of doctrine is fundamentals. We had the fundamentals of deep operations and their relationship to close operations, but we were trying to put it all together. And so by the early 90s, the Gulf War, and particularly right after, we thought we were pretty good at that. You know, the combat training centers had come on board, and we were good. We were really, really good at that. But the pace of change eventually overwhelmed our ability to be really, really, really perfect, you know, having the perfect game plan. But it's something you said that I was thinking about. We were tactically focused. We were large-scale combat operations focused. And so right around 2000, after we did the operations other than war, peace, doctrine took a deliberate turn to elevate other things than the lethal and destructive capabilities the Army had. We formalized the idea of stability operations and support operations in the first version of FM 3-0, the 2001 version of 3-0, when we introduced full spectrum operations. That was a deliberate attempt to say that other things that we do, other than the lethal, destructive things, are equally as important. And so our doctrine changed to reflect that.
Mr. Ben, maybe I am misquoting you. You're talking about how the pace of change started to increase and increase, and then it was harder to become proficient. Is that kind of what you were saying?
It's on a large scale. I think episodically, we have units who will train for a particular deployment, but to say that as an Army, I think by 1991, when we went to Desert Storm, I think the Army and most of the components of the Army were pretty doggone good at this close, deep, and rear air, land battle construct. We thought that we kind of mastered that, and everybody had mastered it. But again, as we had to adapt to counterinsurgency operations, and we had to learn things like key leader engagements, and we didn't call it nation building in doctrine. We didn't say that very much, but those stability operations things, it became harder for us to chart our proficiency in those kinds of things.
Yeah, so it's a couple things wrapped up in that. It's also like the metrics involved.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so the thought that I had, Jim, I was going to mention implementation, you know, and kind of that's one of the enduring problems with doctrine. It's like you can write all you want, but until people understand it and implement it during operations, it doesn't do you any good. And that doesn't happen magically. There's got to be a concerted effort to do that. And when I was a youngster, you know, Airland Battle came out, the both versions, about the same time the CTCs were getting stood up, okay? And so, you know, you started going to CTC rotations either at NTC or at CMTC before it was CMTC or JRTC. And, the OCs were the expertises, right? And they would run you through your paces based on a doctrinal kind of approach to operations. They captured all the lessons learned and they would pass that on to you, you know, during in an AAR. So you would get better, you know, at your job. And BCTP was instrumental to this, okay? I mean, BCTP was really a big part. Battle Command Training Program was really a big part of that. And that gave you the repetitions you needed in order to be competent, you know? And by the time you were probably a captain, there wasn't very many scenarios you hadn't been through either a combat training, you know, a dirt CTC or in a Battle Command Training Program warfighter that you hadn't seen before, you know? So you got the repetitions that help you implement that doctrine that was out there. You know, a couple things I think broke that, you know, first was we kind of went to this MRX model, which was not doctrinally focused during Iraq, the OIF and OEF, where we weren't training guys so much on doctrine as we were training on like, hey, this is what the unit you're doing, TOA with is doing. And so you got to operate that way for like the first 90 days. So that's what you're going to get evaluated on and certified on before we send you over. The other big thing was So it took us away from being focused on doctrine. The other thing is modularity. And I think modularity really screwed the Army up, because one of the beautiful things about the Army of Excellence or Division 86 or whatever we had pre-modularity, you know, you had a division with three brigades in it, and one of those brigades was Red Cycle, one of those brigades was picking up DRB, and then one of those brigades was getting ready to go to NTC. And that brigade that was at DRB had just come out of an NTC rotation, and they were responsible for providing the OC package to the unit getting ready to go to NTC. So you got this constant knowledge transfer at the division level amongst the brigades, battalions, and the companies. And it was like an amazing thing. You know, if you went to 1st CAV, and I was there in 89 to 94, you know, there was this constant, you're either getting ready to go, you're providing OC packs for people ready to go, or you're picking up DRB, where you're getting ready to do your, you know, where you had to get certified on your kind of mental task. So it was very training focused. It was very doctrinally focused. You know, we were constantly passing this lesson learned and writing SOPs, which is something I think we've lost. Additionally, we lost all our good, you know, LISCO SOPs over the years. And now we're trying to recreate that stuff, some of the details that we had. So the implementation piece is something that needs to be constantly worked.
What does DRB stand for?
Division Ready Brigade.
Okay. What you were saying makes me think it's, you really were focused on the division, and the division was training the division. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, because I guess my experience is different because I'm an aviator. So I've never been part of the BCT. But what I have seen is one BCT goes to Korea, the next one's going to Europe, the CAB is going to a different location. So when you're not on the same mission set, even,
yeah, right.
How do you train as a division?
Yeah, I have no idea. Okay, you tell me. That's
so, you know, you're right. Back in the time that Chuck's referring to, the Army was organized in fixed, predictable ways. Again, so many maneuver brigades. By the late 80s, every division had an aviation brigade. And you live together, you train together, and so everything, as he alluded to, it was just repetition, reps and sets, over and over again. You went to the CTCs together, or you trained at home station together. Your medal back then was a handful of tactical combat. It was focused on a small set of tactical tasks, basically offense, defense, and that was it. Once we had to expand our horizons to include other types of activities, the problems became more complicated. And so that's why we demand so much more of soldiers and leaders today from a knowledge basis. We demand so much more. And I think that's been a value of doctrine, because now you can expect that in a new assignment, you're going to be doing a lot of things that you've never done before. And so what didn't happen in my early military life was I rarely heard, well, get me the doctrine on X, because, you know, I'm going to be in the airspace cell in my next assignment, and I need to learn about whatever it is. And it has caused us to now focus on where are the information gaps with the pace of change, new equipment, new requirements, senior leader guidance, with the pace of those inputs impacting leaders. Our biggest challenge has been to keep up, to try to provide the doctrine so that those leaders and soldiers who are doing things for the first time have some material that they can look at to build that judgment and experience base so that they can adapt to situations that they encounter.
So as we're talking pace and all the requirements, additional requirements, what does the future of doctrine look like? I think you just gave us a little hint, Mr. Ben. Are we going to change, do you think, as, you know, as the pace changes? Or are you going to tell me nothing's different?
No, I know. It has to change. About every 5 years, somebody stands up and goes, you know what? Doctrine doesn't change fast enough. There's too much of it. It's too slow. And we need to redo the entire program. And And, you know, I go back and look at when I first came in, and doctoral manuals, beautiful. You know, they were two column on each page. They were like space and a half. They had like three inch margins. They were like size 14 font. They were easy to read, and you could kind of get the big ideas, right? Over the years, you know, the demand has been for more and more and more information. And so we've gone to 10 font in our manuals, which I can't read anymore, okay? And I'm sorry. Yeah, we've gone through several different iterations of, you know, what we consider doctrine. We've turned doctrine into technical manuals. We've turned doctrine into training circulars. We've broken doctrine out into various categories. And the bottom line is like, there's still a requirement for the information. It doesn't matter if you call it doctrine or not. There's still a requirement for it. So I think that in the OE that they're in right now, we can go two ways. I think the current group of folks like demand detail. You know, they want to know very detailed how to, because the SOPs we used to live by and things like that are not out there anymore. And they're being recreated as these guys go on. But, you know, because the situations are so different wherever you go, I see us going back to something like, I really like the ADP idea, but I don't think the ADPs, the fundamentals should change that often. You know, I really think we need to write more broadly and let folks kind of adapt and apply that to their particular situation, rather than dictating, like, this is what you need to do under every particular situation. So the actual doctrine piece, I think, is going to become a little bit broader and more fundamental focused. And I don't know what we're going to do. Maybe it'll stay like the ADP and the FM kind of thing, because the requirement is still out there. Where it goes, I don't know. But, you know, we got to pick a set of fundamentals that people can operate underneath that isn't going to change every couple of years. You know, the Marines have been able to do it. You know, their Marine Corps doctrine pubs, their C2 book's been out there since 97. They made one change in 98 to make it gender neutral, and that's it. And they're talking about redoing it. Meanwhile, we've done our C2 book like five times.
You know, when we were focused on the Soviet threat, our main requirement or focus was, you know, maintaining the sovereignty and territorial integrity of whatever landmass, you know, we were involved in. Well, that's all changed. That has all changed today in the way we, the Army, will approach it. We have to think about not just how are we going to integrate fires and maneuver to prevail, you know, against a peer adversary looking towards the future. We're going to have to think seriously about how, in the dime paradigm, how is the military going to be affected by diplomacy and economic developments? How are we going to be affected? And how will our actions and the employment of our capabilities impact the other pieces of the dime paradigm? Because it's complex.
It's interesting because, you know, here I'm hearing complex world that we live in, but we need to have foundational. We don't want to be too detailed. I'm going to throw in another thing too, that generationally, we know Gen Z is not apt to pick up a 300-page book.
Yeah, right.
So how are we evolving for the next generations also, so that they are actually reading doctrine?
Maybe in the future, they won't read doctrine. Maybe that this medium that we're taking part in right now is the primary exchange of knowledge and information. That we don't know, but you are absolutely right. The printed word, I don't know what's going to become of the printed word, but like Chuck said, the requirement for the information is going to be there. Somebody's going to have to compile and organize information in so that it can be easily understood and shared.
Yeah, I was going to say, so like I hear what you're saying about Gen Z, you know, and the counter to that would be like, we bring people in the Army, if they're not in shape, we make them get in shape. If they can't shoot, we make them shoot, you know? So like, I don't really buy this, like, nobody's going to read argument. You know what? If the requirement is read doctrine, then they're going to read, we're going to make them read doctrine. That's number one. That being said, I understand that people learn differently, and there's a variety of things we've done over the years to kind of implement doctrine in various mediums in various ways, right? So, you know, there's the written word. We've got these audiobooks that people are, I personally thought it was an awful idea, but apparently it's been a big hit. You know, I personally can't think of anything worse than driving along, listening to somebody read ADP 6.0 to me or ADP 3.13, but there's people that enjoy that, all right? And then there's people that like to watch the Chain Teach videos and things like that. But ultimately, you have to get back. Like, those are only designed to, like, give you a taste, you know, and make you hopefully pique your interest so you go back to the actual written word and start taking a look. You know, we have all these call lessons learned, and we have, I mean, there's tons of doctrine out there, but there's no way to go in and say, hey, give me everything you got on, you know, the infantry squad and the defense, you know, and boom, this, it just compiles a book for you. And it pulls from various doctrinal manuals, but you can kind of set parameters to only get the things that you want, you know? So like there's this fundamental out there, you know, idea, then there's fundamentals of defense. But then you can gather up all the lessons learned and things like that from other sources fairly easily. You know, I know that was a dream one time. It would like print you a little like a leader's book on how to do all that stuff. I thought that was a pretty cool idea. But I think the resources involved would be huge. And like, if we were going to do it right, you really have to sit down and think about it. You couldn't do it, you know, kind of halfway. You would have it. The people and the tech guys and everything else involved in that, I think, would be pretty huge.
The top agency involved in the doctrine development process, the Army Publishing Directorate, they maintain the official repositories and stuff. Prediction, the Army Publishing Directorate is the agency that's going to undergo the biggest change the soonest, because they're going to feel the pressure of artificial intelligence and the ability to generate and share information. But I just heard on another Sunday morning show, another warning about artificial intelligence and our ability to trust the input that we get. So that's gonna pose the biggest challenge. And since the Army Publishing Directorate is responsible for verifying and authenticating the accuracy of information, they're going to have to really, really sprint to catch up. We have a huge challenge. The doctrine community has a huge challenge because we're being constantly bombarded with innovation, new challenges, and there's unyielding pressure to keep pace with these changes. Our leaders want to know right now, how is artificial intelligence impacting doctrine? Our leaders want to know right now, have we accounted for the human machine interface? And our biggest challenge as a doctrine development community is that decisions get made before we are ready, before we are intellectually prepared to implement them. And so the frustrating thing for our leaders is, until the Army as an entity is able to intellectually absorb information and innovation, it just doesn't happen. And so the task that we are looking at, we've just started looking at, is who is going to be the lead sled dog in all of these activities, because we know that individually, the capability development and integration directorates at each of the COEs has a lane that they're pursuing. And how will we bring all that together? How will we make sure that the sustainment center of excellence and fire center of excellence and maneuver and aviation, are they maintaining an appropriate level of compatibility as they each charge forward with their innovation efforts? Is that an Army Futures Command responsibility? Is it a Training and Doctrine Command responsibility? Now, when there was a closer lash up between concepts, doctrine, and capability development, there was at one time a closer association with those activities. Right now, I think at some place on the planet, there is consideration about how are we going to bring those activities into closer alignment? And I won't speculate or start rumors, but aligning capability development, doctrine development, and concept development, aligning those activities is going to be huge as we go forward.
They call it foreshadowing, I think. Is that what that's called?
Yes, indeed.
Anything else before we wrap up?
You know, as daunting as these challenges might seem, I just think it's going to be great fun to work on these challenges and try to solve these problems. And yes, artificial intelligence is going to give us some bumps and bruises. And we're going to stumble a couple of times. And I hope that we don't have to pay for it in human lives. So, you know, I hope that it's just the lessons learned are just inconveniences. So we're going to take some lumps from artificial intelligence, but we'll get over it and we will prevail. I'm confident of that.
I think things now are that we're postured to actually perform in a much better manner than we have in the past. You know, I look back at kind of how this thing ran when I first started doing it. When you first started doing it, it was like, hey, we're just going to send people there. And, you know, you didn't always get high quality people being assigned as doctrine providers. With AIM 2 now, a couple of things happen. You got AIM 2 and you have people that are here that want to do this. So we got the people, the quality people that are really good thinkers in here. And then they're smart and they don't just accept what they're given blindly. If you're given something by concepts or anybody else and you start reading it and it doesn't make sense, you don't have to take it, okay? Don't just take what they give you and slam it into doctrine. That's kind of been a problem that's come up the past. If we take some conceptual ideas, slap it in doctrine, but really it doesn't do any good. It's like there's no detail to support it. We're lucky because we have leadership that is open to change. So if you do identify a problem, you can take it to your boss, whether it be the CAD director, the COE director, the CAT commander, or the TRADOC commander.
The one great comfort I have is that through all of my experience doing this, the leaders have been anxious, you know, to speed up the process, but they have always said, I know what the timeline is, but I want you to get it right. I have never had, and I don't know if anyone here has ever encountered a situation where it was, give it to me now, I don't care what it looks like. The leadership has always insisted, yes, you're too slow, but I want you to get it right. And that's been our salvation, I think.
Well, thanks for joining us and sharing your reflections.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate the opportunity.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the Kerr and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on Amazon Music, Apple, Odyssey, Audible, Spotify, or YouTube. Also, go ahead and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.